So in Ephesians chapter 5, and we're going to pick it up in verse 22, just like we did last week, and read into chapter 6, verse number 4. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, if the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth it and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. Now, when we get into chapter 6, that's where we're going to be here for this particular study, but I reference the verses we talked about in the first part. So he talks about the husband and the wife, and then he gets into about the children and the parents, starting in chapter 6, verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long in the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Let me begin with this statement. God has no grandchildren. God has no grandchildren. You're not saved because of your parents. Either you're a direct child of God or you're not born again. So God has no grandchildren. Now we talk about, and I use this phrase, and I'm not criticizing you using the phrase, but I want you to understand the phrase. Okay, we talk about first, second, or third generation Christians. And what we mean by that is first generation, that means you had no prior people in your family who were born again. Your parents weren't born again, your grandparents. And so you're the first generation. You didn't get saved because you know your parents were born again. They got you to church, and now you're born again. Maybe you're a bus kid, or maybe you got saved later in life, but you're a first generation. Second generation means that your parents were born again, and now you're born again. Not because they were born again, but they've trusted Christ, you trusted Christ. Third generation, grandparents, parents, you. That's what it means. But in reality, everyone is a first-generation believer. It doesn't matter who your parents were and how you came to church or how you heard the gospel. You got saved because you put your faith. It doesn't matter if your parents, your grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, great-great-great-grandparents, if they were all born-again people, it didn't make you any more saved. It doesn't make you any less saved. So you have to decide for yourself. So ultimately, in reality, there's only first-generation believers. Each person must decide for himself what he will do regarding belief in Christ. Now, a lot of times religion and Catholicism is this way, especially Polish Catholics or Russian Catholics I'm trying to think of other big Catholic, Romanian Catholic, especially when they're that way. Religion can be generational and cultural. In other words, why are you a Catholic? Well, my parents are Catholics, and my grandparents are Catholic. And in fact, Kathy Stein had that testimony. She grew up in a Polish, right? Polish Catholic home. Her parents were Catholics. Grandparents are Catholics. I mean, that's what they were, and that's what you were, because that's what you grew up in. You were a Catholic, and they say, well, why are you a Catholic? Well, my parents are Catholic, so I must be Catholic. And not only was it generational, it was cultural. There's a lot of extended parts that all of the different things that meant about being a Catholic because of your heritage or because of your family. And a lot of times when you leave that, you're disowned because it's so entwined in the culture. So religion can be generational and cultural, but Christianity is very personal. It's what you personally decided about Jesus Christ. So it's a very personal thing. Having believers as parents does not guarantee that the child will be saved, nor does it guarantee the child will follow the Lord. Just like being saved doesn't mean your kids are automatically going to be saved. Just because you're following the Lord doesn't mean your kids automatically are going to follow the Lord. Because the same truth would be for both. Now, sometimes when I say that, people get a little bothered by it. And they say, well, then why even try then? Okay, if I do all the right things and that's not a guarantee, why even try? Well, I don't think that's the way to look at it. And I think if you think about it, you'd understand that's really not a good way to look at it. But the truth is, having believers as parents does not guarantee a good outcome for the children, but it does offer a better chance of one. A child has a better chance of following the Lord if the parents are following the Lord. And I think this, if the parents are saved, wouldn't that be a better chance the kid might get saved? I mean, if you grew up in a home and no one in your family was saved, I mean, who's going to get you the gospel? Hopefully someone will knock on the door, maybe a co-worker when you get older, or maybe if you're in school, a kid. But if you grow up in a home and your parents are saved and they know clearly what that means, don't you think the parents would be concerned about their children? Of course they would. And so I think a child grow up in a Christian home with parents who are saved and trying to live for the Lord would probably have the best opportunity to hear the gospel and be saved. And kids who grow up in a Christian home with parents who love the Lord and follow the Lord have the best opportunity to do likewise. So parents who train their children according to the Bible give those children the best start. So go with me to, you can hold your place, we'll come back to Ephesians in a moment, but go with me to Psalms 127. This is how we started the Bible study, Psalms 127. It really gave us the title for this particular study. We'll just, it's only five verses, so we'll read the psalm together, or I'll read it, you follow along. Psalms 127, look with me in verse number 1. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Then he talks about this, and this is where, kind of helps us where we're going here in just a few moments. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children in the youth. Now, you might remember a couple months ago, Brother Cleveland, in his testimony, started preaching to us about this. Remember that? About aiming the arrows, and this is what he was talking about. It was good. I teased him, but I'm glad he said it. It was very good. Happy is a man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. And so the Bible tells us about building the house, but also talks about us aiming children in the right direction like you would aim an arrow. So, the job of parents is to aim their children at the right target. An aimed arrow has the best chance of hitting the target. If you're aiming the arrow, you have the best chance of hitting the target because it's being aimed at that target. Yet, okay, so I'm trying to give you both sides so that we get a balance. I don't want you to be going into a ditch here. Yet, even an aimed arrow can miss the target. Now, when I was a kid, I had a bow and arrow. I mean, I don't mean like a, you know, little suction cup arrow. I'm talking about, I had a big recurve bow. We went bow hunting, deer hunting with a bow. My friend Robbie had a compound bow, but I just had a recurve bow. And so we'd sometimes go up there on the hill above our house, and we'd be shooting at targets. And I can tell you, I aimed at the target. I can't tell you I always hit the target, but I aimed at the target. My goal was hit the target. I mean, it was a target. It was there, and that's what I was trying to hit. But I noticed that I didn't always hit what I aimed at. Now, if the target's there and I'm like this, okay, obviously I'm not. But I was trying to hit the target. I was aiming. I was concentrating. But I didn't always hit it because there are reasons at times you miss the target. First of all, I'm going to give you these two, and we're going to kind of apply it when you think about children. Then I'm going to get into more specifics about it. Why, if you're aiming an arrow, now if we think about child rearing, about trying to get a child to go the right direction, why, if we're aiming an arrow, why would it miss the target? Well, there's two reasons. One is this, that the sights are wrong. Now, if I were to switch over and instead of talking about bow and arrow and talk about a rifle, the other day I took my I turned a High Point carbine into a bullpup, which means nothing to you unless you're in the guns. You're like, oh yeah, that's cool, man, that's cool, and it was cool. And so I was at the range. I was trying to zero in on the target. So I have my crosshairs, and I have it on this thing, so it's just sitting there. And I have it on my, I have the crosshairs right on the bullseye. So here's the bullseye, and I'm hitting here. Now, the reason is because my sight, I just put the sight on, and the sight wasn't adjusted. So I had to take it down, I'd adjust it, put it back up, and I shot again, and put the bullseye on it, so I'm looking right at it. And so if this is the bullseye, so it hit here, and then it hit over here. And I said, well, it went the right direction, but not up. So now I went up, and then I shot over here. And I said, well, that's kind of weird how that happened. And then the next time, I hit pretty close to the bullseye. And we'll just call it, I hit the bullseye. And so, not exactly, but it was at the very edge of it. Now, I had to adjust the sight. Now here's the key. Here's what I'm trying to get you. When I'm looking at that sight, at that bullseye, it's always right on it. Okay? That's the key. I'm aiming right at the bullseye, but I'm not hitting the bullseye because the sight isn't adjusted right. So improper sights miss what they're aiming at. In other words, if we put this to child rearing, good intention sometimes become a bad performance. I don't think most Christian parents who love the Lord and are trying to raise their kids, I don't think they have bad intention. I don't think they say, well, you know, I don't really care. I don't care if my kids love the Lord or live for the Lord. I don't really care. No, they care. They love the Lord. They want their kids to love the Lord. They're living for the Lord. They want their kids to live for the Lord. It is the heart of every parent who loves and loves the Lord and lives for Him. Now, you're aiming at that bullseye, but sometimes your aim may not be as it should be. In fact is, every parent's aim is off some because of our own sin nature, our own misunderstanding about things. If you go online, especially on social media, you'll find, I would just call them bitter Baptists and former fundamentalists. These people who complain about every reason why they're not living for the Lord. And they'll gripe about imperfect parents, imperfect churches, imperfect pastors, imperfect colleges, etc. ad nauseum. And that's their excuse for not living for the Lord. They're saying, well, if they're wrong, 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 and therefore it gives me an excuse to be wrong. And it's not an excuse. If every believer you've ever met is wrong, it does not give you an excuse to be wrong. And God is not going to give you a pass. God's not going to say, well, yeah, I know you went such and such church or such and such college or this was, you know, this was your hero in the faith and they disappointed you. God's going to say, what did you do with what you knew? Yeah. You say, well, you don't see it that way. But God sees it that way. Romans 14. Romans 14. I kind of chuckle. I don't know what people are going to do when they get to heaven and they face the Lord. They're going to like, well, wait a minute, God, let me get on my Facebook. Let me see what my friends say. There ain't no Facebook here, and I don't really care what your friends say. Romans 14, look at verse 11. Now hold your place here because we're going to look at this in just a moment again, slightly different. Romans 14, verse 11. For it is written, as I live, saith the Lord, every knee shall bow to me and every tongue shall confess to God. So then, okay, so that's the outcome of this. So if we back up where we're at today, so then every one of us shall give an account of himself to God. So however I'm living, I better understand I'm living today that I'm giving an account because I am going to bow the knee and I am going to confess with my tongue. So ultimately, there are no excuses and there are no exceptions for not serving the Lord. Regardless of upbringing, regardless of mistreatment. Now, let me give you time out in the field. I am not talking about people who have been physically / sexually abused. Okay, that's a whole different category. The answer for child molestation is simple. If someone is a child molester, if they go to court and they're found guilty in a just trial, I say, give them a shovel. say, I want you to dig a hole right there about 6 foot 3 inches long, about 6 foot deep, and you let them dig their own grave, shoot them back to head, fill it in the hole. I have no mercy on that kind of behavior. If you were to harm a child that way, once you're found guilty of it, you ought to have a fair trial. Okay, so I'm not in any way excusing any type of abuse of children in that way. But I'm talking about life wasn't, someone told me just recently, they grew up in a family. When you turned 18, you're out the door. It didn't matter. You're out the door. You're 18, bye. I don't have a job. Better go find one. I don't got anywhere to live. Hope you find a place. I mean, that was, and they had multiple kids. And that was the rule. When you're 18, you're out the door. Period. Why? That is not very nice. No, it isn't. But then give me an excuse not to live for the Lord. But I had a friend and he could stay at home till he was 30. Yeah, you know, he lived in the basement playing video games. And you say, but my parents didn't let that happen. That doesn't give you an excuse not to live for the Lord. No one has an excuse not to live for the Lord. And so, yes, parents need to aim children. But even if the sights are not all they should have been, you need to live for the Lord regardless. I mean, think about this. If a perfect environment is required to live for God, then Adam has no excuse, and everyone else does. Because Adam's the only one with the perfect environment, and he blew it. So if imperfection is a reason not to live for the Lord, then no one would ever live for the Lord because everyone would have an excuse. Everyone has reasons to excuse. So at first, his sights are wrong. Well, why else, if you aim the arrow, why would it miss the target? Well, sometimes the sights are wrong. So not every parent gets it right. Not every pastor gets it right. Not every college gets it right. Not every church gets it right. Not every spiritual mentor gets it right. Not every fellow believer gets it right. And then there's a second, and that is crooked arrows. Crooked arrows fly crooked. And if you got some issues in your own life, no matter how much your parents are pointing you, you're not going to hit that target. Back to my bow and arrow days. When we would go out target practice, and we had two sets of arrows. We had the arrows that we, hunting arrows, they had the big razor tips on them, four half razor blades, very sharp, I can tell you, because I sliced my finger open on one of them. So very sharp. Those were the nice metal, and they had to be nice and straight. On the practice ones, they were either cheaper aluminum or wooden ones, and we would just be shooting at the target, and eventually it's ripping out the feathers. The tip is getting bent, the arrow's getting a little crooked, and when that happens, it doesn't matter how well you're aiming that thing, you let it go, and that, you can watch the arrow go like this. Because the reason the arrow's crooked, and it's never going to fly straight when you have a crooked arrow. So crooked arrows fly crooked. And the greater the crookedness, the greater the bent, the greater the miss. If we go back to Romans 14:11, in verse 12 again, For it is written, as I live, saith the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess. You know the best time to bow your knee and confess with your tongue? At a very early age. Because the earlier you do that, the earlier verse 11 occurs in your life, the better verse 12 is going to be. The quicker you bow that knee and confess with that tongue, the better that giving an account of yourself is going to be. So I tell you this tonight, God specializes in making crooked things straight. And the sooner you submit, the better it will be. So we're talking about aiming our children, trying to teach our children some things, and over the next couple of lessons, that's what it'll be, things we're going to try to teach our children. I don't want to let parents off and say, well, you know, just whatever your kids want to do. No, we have a responsibility. We're aiming. We're supposed to know what the target is and aim at that target. It's a parent's responsibility to know the target and to aim at the target. But I don't want to flip it where we think that, let me just say this, there are some kids who've turned out well in spite of their parents. But I tell you, I'm looking at their parents and thinking, how did you come from that mess? And there's other kids you look at and you say, Well, how did you turn out that way when your parents were this way? I mean, the parents are the mess and the kids are golden. In other places, the parents are golden, the kids are the mess. And so it's not always transactional the way we want it to be. Great parents, great kids. Sometimes it's lousy parents and great kids. And sometimes it's great parents and lousy kids. But it's our job as parents to aim, but we have to understand there's sometimes reasons why the arrows don't hit the target. Not an excuse. No parent is happy, but that's the reality of it. So I won't give you, starting tonight, I'll just give you one. My thought is I'll give you four overall, but I'm going to give you one major lesson and then break it down into some sub-lessons. So let's go back to Ephesians 6 in verse number 1. And we'll look at the first lesson about this, about teaching our children. Verse 1, again of chapter 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. This is what the Lord wants. This is the right thing for children to obey their parents. So number one, very simple, is this. Children are to be taught obedience. Now, it's interesting. Obedience is listed first. And the reason I think it's listed first is because it's the first thing that can be taught. It's the first thing that should be taught. And I think the first thing that must be taught. It may be hard to teach a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old about all the things of God, the deep doctrines of the Bible, but you can teach them some basic obedience. Now, I want you to listen carefully to this statement. Even though our expectation of obedience and the consequence of disobedience, which we'll talk about in a moment, even though our expectation of obedience and thus the consequence of disobedience may change, even young children can be taught to obey. Now, here's what I mean. What I expect out of a 4-year-old is going to be different than what I expect out of a 10-year-old versus what I expect out of a 15-year-old. I'm going to expect obedience, but I'm not necessarily the same obedience. What a 15-year-old can do is a whole lot more than what that 4-year-old can do. And therefore, the consequence of how I'm going to handle a 4-year-old and his disobedience is different than I would think about handling a 15-year-old and their disobedience. So even though the expectation may change and the consequence may change as they get older and they develop and they mature, but nevertheless, even in youth, even in the younger years, there should be an expectation of obedience that's, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but that's appropriate for them. So when we say children ought to be taught obedience, what does that mean? Because I think everyone's like, yeah, children ought to obey. Well, what does it mean, children ought to obey? How does that look like if it actually happens? Well, I'm going to look at it and give you three things I've taught multiple times, but I think we always need to be reminded of. The first is this, children should be taught joyful obedience. Go with me to 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5. First John chapter 5, look at verse 1. Now, just so you understand, parental obedience is supposed to mirror, so how a child obeys its parent is supposed to mirror how the parents are obeying the Lord. So when we look at our obedience to the Lord, that's how our children obeying us should, there should be a mirroring or something similar to the two. So 1 John chapter 5, verse 1, whosoever believeth that Jesus is Christ, is the Christ, is born of God, and everyone that loveth him and that begat loveth him also that is begotten of him. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep his commandments. Then he says this, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not, what's the next word? Grievous. In other words, I should never be complaining about the commands of God. Well, it's just so hard to serve God. God ain't fair, and I don't like what he tells me to do. But he said his commands are not grievous. So if I got a problem with the commandments of God, is the problem with God or is the problem with me? The problem is with me. And the same thing mirrors now when we think about our children. So parents should make sure the commands given to a child are age appropriate and understandable. That's important. If you go back to our text here, Ephesians 6. In verse 4, and ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Well, one of the things to provoke to wrath, if you're asking a 4-year-old to do things that 15-year-olds are supposed to be doing. That would not be fair to them. That would not be just. We talk about justice Sunday night. And so they need to be age-appropriate, and they need to be understandable. And we'll kind of come back to circle back around to that, I think, towards the end of the Bible lesson. But we ought to make sure that they not agreeable, not that the children agree with the command, but they need to understand what they're being told to do, that there's an understanding of this is the expectation upon you. Okay, so it should be understandable. They know what to do, and they're able to do it. Okay, if you had a 2-year-old and you tell your 2-year-old to go make his bed, 2-year-old's going, it's not really age appropriate, and you can explain all you want, but then, they're going to sit there and just suck their thumb and look at you like they have no idea what you're saying because they have no idea what you're saying. All right, so it's got to be age appropriate. It's got to be understandable. Now that means this: parents should not allow griping or complaining as commands are obeyed, because that would be not joyful obedience. We all have our own history with our own parents, and some people would say this: well, when I was a kid, if I complained, my parents would whack me or whatever. But that's not always true. Sometimes we say things that aren't true about that because, whatever age you are, you knew people when you were a kid who complained and griped, and the parents let them get away with it. I tell you, in my case, you can believe it or not, but in my case, my mom never tolerated that. We would sit in a restaurant, and we basically, I don't think we ever even talked. Now, me and my brother in a car or out and about, we would goof around or fight or whatever, but that was away from the crowd. But when we were in a crowd, that did not happen because, man, my mom would look at us and she'd just go this: you wait until you get outside. We're like, oh, no. And my mom, you would think that my mom was as nice as Howdy Doody. She was so nice and laughing and pleasant until. So we go home. It'd be like a couple hours later. Here I am 10, 11 years old. I'm thinking, yeah, she forgot. All of a sudden, Denny, come here. Oh, no. Doom, doom, doom. What were you doing in the restaurant when I told you to straighten up? And then she would remember, and it came time to pay the piper. So anyways, nonetheless, there should be an expectation of joyful obedience. If there's griping and complaining, that's obviously not joyful. So children should be taught joyful obedience. Second thing is this: children should be taught immediate obedience. Let me ask you a question. If you told me, if you came to me and said, Pastor White, God has told me, I mean, I am sure of it. Not in a voice, but in my heart, He has completely led me. I am completely convinced that God wants me this Sunday to put $100 in the offering plate. I said, well, if that's what the Lord wants, and you don't do it, and you wait a week, and you wait another week, and you wait another week, what would you call that? Disobedience. So if God wants you to do something this Sunday, when should you do it? This Sunday. That's obedience. That's what the Lord wants. Now, we know that because that's how it is described in the Bible. Look with me in the book of Acts, chapter 16. Acts 16. And verse number 9. And a vision appeared to Paul in the night. There stood a man in Macedonia and prayed him, saying, come over into Macedonia and help us. Verse 10, after he had seen the vision, immediately we endeavored to go into Macedonia, assuredly gathering that the Lord had called us for to preach the gospel unto them. That's the obedience the Lord wants, this type of immediate obedience. Now, let me take a moment and explain it this way. Well, let me give you this statement. How's that first? Delayed obedience is disobedience. So let me now explain it. The what of a command, the what you're telling them to do, should be obeyed immediately. Now, I'm all for explaining the whys. Why do we do this? Why is it has to be done this way? But the why may take longer. To explain the why behind of things may take longer. But the immediate what, if we go back to Acts 16, did Paul know why he was supposed to go to Macedonia? No. He knew what. Now, do we know why? Yeah, later on, I'm sure even Paul later on said, oh, it makes sense now. Now I see what God was doing. Yeah, there's a whole field here. This is surely God's will. That's not how it started. Here's how it started. God said, go. And he said, okay, I'll go. Now, in the process of obeying, he kind of learned the why. So the what should be obeyed immediately, even if the why may take longer to understand. So delayed obedience is disobedience. So let me give you one more statement about this. It sounds simple, but it's just basic. Children are not obeying until they are obeying. If they're not obeying, they're not obeying. They're not obeying when they're arguing or fussing or oh yeah, I'll do it, oh yeah, I'll do it, but you're not doing it. That's the thing. You're not doing it. Until you're doing it, you're not obeying. So children should be taught immediate obedience. There's a third. So what we said, according to Ephesians 6:1, children, obey your parents. What does that look like? Well, it's joyful obedience. It's immediate obedience. What else kind of obedience is it? Well, the third is this. Children should be taught complete obedience. Now, when you were a kid, and when I was a kid, and when your kids were kids, and when my kids were kids, we always basically, they did the same thing. Which is, they tried to do enough to stay out of trouble, but not necessarily enough to make it hard on them. For example, if you say, clean the room, it would not be unusual. Let's say, so I have two of my kids sitting over here. So here's Bethany and here's Jason. So if I said to either one of them, clean your room, it would not be unusual for them to, and I come back and there's a room clean. Boy, this room is nice and clean. And then I open the closet. It's like Fibber McGee and Molly. And all of a sudden you open that's an old radio classic, kind of like Gunsmoke, okay? Okay. So anyways, you open the closet door and everything's falling out of it. I'm like, I thought I told you to clean your room. Well, it's all in there, but it's not put away. No, you put it where it belongs. It doesn't, or here's a classic thing. You open the, you look under the bed and you realize, so that's where everything is. No, you got to start putting stuff away. So you want complete obedience. And that's what the Lord wants. How do I know that? How do I know the Lord wants complete obedience? Well, let's go to 1 Samuel 15. But they were perfect angels. These are my two good kids. It's the other three that were the problem child. Okay, 1 Samuel. These are my favorites, right? You're my two favorites. 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15. Look at verse 18. Is this not the obedience the Lord wants? He wants joyful obedience, he wants immediate obedience, and he wants complete obedience. And this is the case with King Saul. Verse 18, 1 Samuel 15, verse number 18. And the Lord sent the angel. Now, this is Samuel, and we're right in the middle of the... Okay, I guess I got to back up for a moment. So here's what's happening. Samuel says to Saul, go and kill Agag and all of the Amalekites. Kill everything, every creature, every person. Wipe it out. And King Saul says, yes, sir. Here we go. We're marching. And though they go and they fight the battle and then they come back and they have the king with them and they have a lot of the animals with them. And Samuel goes out to meet him to see how it went. Now, if he killed everything, how much would they be bringing back? Zero. But they're bringing stuff back. This is where we get into the story. So, 1 Samuel 15, verse 18 says this, and the Lord sent thee on a journey and said, this is Samuel talking to Saul, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them till they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of the Lord, but didst fly upon the spoil, and didst evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, I love this here. Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalekite, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. Well, if you brought Agag, then you didn't kill them all. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, is sacrificing the Lord thy God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, now, they did a lot. They killed a lot of people. They wiped out, but they didn't do it completely. And you think, here's how God would say, well, you know, you did 80%. Good job, kid. He said, no, I told you to do everything. It isn't that God is expecting perfection. God is expecting obedience. This was possible. It wasn't something that was impossible. It was possible. If they killed all of these people but saved a few alive, they could have killed everyone. If they killed all the animals and saved a few, they could have killed all the animals. It wasn't an impossible thing. It wasn't beyond their ability, but it was beyond their desire. They didn't want to obey completely. They wanted something else. And so now God's going to confront them with their incomplete obedience. And he says this in verse 22. And Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices, because they had, you know, we always turn our disobedience into like we're doing it for Jesus. I know I didn't do it, but I know I'm sinning, but I'm doing it for Jesus. As in obeying the voice of the Lord. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and a hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is iniquity and idolatry. Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, he hath also rejected thee from being king. That's pretty harsh, but that was the consequence for their disobedience. So children should be taught complete obedience. Whatever job a child is given to a child to perform, it should be performed completely and properly. Now, obviously, you got to check up to make sure on that at times. I tell you, not every time. It's like probably the same thing my kids, same thing when I was a manager at Long John Silver's. I would tell them they had certain duties they had to do. And let's say it was the people who were cleaning, which was usually a lady or they're teenagers. A girl who did the dining room, a guy who did the fryers, and they knew their job. And so when I did my shifts, they knew exactly what was the expectation. They were trained, they were explained, they knew exactly what to do. And most of the time they would do it, but a few times they wouldn't do it. But you didn't know which times they're doing it and not do it. So every now and then, and they'd get their job done. They come to me and they say, hey, I got everything done. Can I punch out? And I say, sure, punch out and go home. Sometimes I'd say, no, let me go check. And they say, well, wait a minute. I think I missed a table. and they come back like 20 minutes later. Okay, that table's done. I said, good, you can go ahead and go home. And then sometimes I would say, they'd say, I'm done. I said, let me go check. And they would think, because they would they'd miss a few tables thinking I wouldn't find the tables they missed. And I would check a few tables and I wouldn't get the tables and they would got away with it. And then sometimes I'd say, you know what? I think I really need to check every table this time. And you start checking tables. And the reason is because there has to be a completion of a complete type of obedience. And so you don't necessarily check everything every time, but you do check because you want complete obedience. So we talked about delayed obedience is disobedience. Now, partial or incomplete obedience is disobedience. So there's more we could say about this idea about what to teach our children. We're just sticking with verse 1 about children obey your parents. We're talking about teaching obedience. But I want to give you just a quick second part to this lesson. I'll try not to be too long on it. So we're teaching them obedience. Now here is the not so fun part. And that is, there should be consequences to disobedience. Why? Because unenforced rules are not rules, but suggestions. Let me ask you, if the speed limit said whatever it said, but you knew that you'd never get a ticket, how tempted would you be to keep the speed limit? Be like, when it worked. But unenforced rules are not rules, but suggestions. So when we talk about consequences, what are we talking about? Let me give you these quickly. Ready? It is best that the consequences is decided and explained along with the command. When you tell your child to do something, they should know the consequence of not doing it. There's a reason for that. You don't want the disobedience to get you mad and then you respond out of anger. Okay, you don't want to say, well, I'm going to beat you half to death for that. Okay, unless you explain ahead of time, like if you don't do what I say, I beat you half to death, which obviously you're not going to say it that way. You give them, you say, okay, here's the expectation and here's the consequences. And it's usually an ongoing thing. It's not usually a day by day. Usually they know what the consequences are, but it should be clear, because you don't want unfair consequences because you're upset because of a disobedience. So, let me move on because I got more to say about that. The consequence should be only as severe as needed. You can't be killing your kids over every little thing. Not everything is worth beating them half to death. And again, obviously, I'm not talking about literally beating them. I'm using that in a hyperbole, there's a word for that. Hypothetical, exaggerated statement, okay? Which, because I'm going to cover that in a moment. Okay? So you don't want to be so severe over everything. Everything's not life or death. Because if everything's life or death, then you know, not making your bed is just as bad as you burn down the neighbor's house, which is obviously not the same. Here's the third. Never administer discipline when you're angry. Every parent probably violates this at one time, but it's one thing that we should fight against. Because it's not fair to the child. It's not fair to the child to be losing your temper, because what happens is the next, which is this. Never administer discipline that is abusive. You don't slap them side the head. You don't kick them. You don't throw them down. You don't punch them. You're never abusive in physically or even verbally. You don't sit there and just run them down. You stupid moron kid. Don't you have any sense? Boy, you're just as dumb as a brick. Okay, that's not needed. That is absolutely not needed. That is not discipline, by the way. You're not disciplining that child. Okay, that is not discipline. So we don't administer discipline when we're angry. And we don't administer discipline that is abusive. I'll give you a couple others quickly. Do not change rules out of pressure or weariness. As parents, we're tempted to do this. Every child feels that rules are unfair. You did as a child. Your children feel that way. Your grandchildren are going to feel that way. Every child feels that rules are unfair because they want what they want and the rules keep them from it. And that's not fair. And sometimes they think the parents are out to make their lives miserable, which is not true most of the time. And also, being consistent can be very wearisome, but you can't change just because I'm just tired of dealing with it. So we're just going to get rid of the rule. Okay, that's not a reason to get rid of the rule. If it's a good rule, keep it. Quickly, a couple more. Do not refuse to change rules out of stubbornness or laziness. Only God has perfect rules that never need changing. Whatever rules you have in your house, they're not perfect. Don't need changing at times. Now, Bethany is child one. Jason is child four. We had five children. Well, six, including Ted, but we don't talk about Ted. So anyways, that's a joke. It's a family joke. So Jason is child four. Now, I'm going to tell you this, and I don't think I've ever said it to them, but Bethany's known this, okay? Between child one and child four, some of the rules changed because we grew. We learned some things. We grew in our knowledge of the Bible and our knowledge of child rearing. So you don't want to be so stubborn and say, this is my rule. It will never change. Heaven and hell may pass away, but the rules of Dennis White never change. Okay, no. Only God's word is perfect. And sometimes you got to learn and you make some. So you don't want to not change out of stubbornness. And at the same time, you don't want to be lazy and not do what's needed. So you don't want to be so stubborn you never change, or so lazy that you don't even think about, hey, maybe there's a better way of doing this. Maybe someone says, hey, you know, let me tell you some things I learned. You're like, whoa, you know what? That's good. I think I need to change my rule because that matches that up. And so sometimes you got to change them. You're not trying to compromise. You're not dealing with pressure. You've learned and you've grown, and there's nothing wrong with that. And then the last is this. It's funny what I just said a moment ago here. Do not show favoritism between children when it comes to discipline. I love all my children. I just love some more than others. Do not show favoritism between children when it comes to discipline. If you have the same rule for all the children, and if one did it, then the next one who does it should get the same discipline. All right. Now, there's a lot more to say, but we want to save it for the other couple of points that follow chapter 6, verse 1. So, Lord willing, we'll have three more parts to it and try to round it off. There's certain unbalancing of that lesson, but I want to save the other parts of it to the other lessons. All right. Let's pray. Let's ask the Lord's blessing.